Hello, podcast listeners. It's Dr. Andy here from Museum Victoria and 3RRR. You're about to eavesdrop in on a fascinating conversation about climate change. And climate change not just as an environmental issue or a political and economic issue, but as a serious community health issue. This is an edited version of an event held by the Australian Medical Writers Association and the Victorian branch of the Australian Science Communicators. It's entitled Building Healthy Community Engagement About the Impacts of Climate Change. It was recorded on March the 6th, 2012. One of the voices you're about to hear is Ian Muchamore, head of the Victorian branch of Australian Science Communicators. He hosts the event. But before he introduces the speakers, here's what someone in the audience said about the event. Dimity Williams is a GP. Dimity, what did you think of this event?
I thought it was terrific. I learnt some great ideas about keeping messages simple and clear and talking about individuals' health and how climate change will impact upon that.
So what led to this glowing reference? Here's Ian introducing the first speaker.
Dr. Marion Carey is a public health physician who leads the Climate Change, Biodiversity and Health Program at the Monash University Sustainability Program. So Marion, you have an extensive background in tonight's topic. Can you highlight for us some of the key findings that illustrate why climate change is a risk to human health and where your scientific inquiry has led you?
I'm a public health physician, so I'm wearing three hats. Public health physicians are interested in preventative health and the health of populations. The other hat I'm wearing, as Ian said, is a researcher who's interested in links between human health and the environment, and also as an advocate through Doctors for the Environment Australia. And I feel that as health professionals, we do have a responsibility, an ethical responsibility, to advocate. Climate change, it's really an environmental issue, not really a health issue, is it? But gradually that started to change. We saw that information was coming from overseas, particularly about heat. So there was evidence that in temperate cities such as Melbourne, populations that weren't acclimatised to heat were at risk. And we started to say, well, maybe we should be having a look at this, and found that when there was severe heat days, there was a change in ambulance call-outs, in GP visits and so forth. And then in 2009, we had that very severe heat wave, who anyone living in Melbourne at the time I'm sure would remember. And within 1 week, that was the week before the Black Saturday bushfires, we had 3 days over 43 degrees, and there was an increase in ambulance call-outs of about 25%, about double that on the hottest days. The hospital presentations rose by about 12%, and there were 374 excess deaths. So it had an obvious and immediate impact on health, such that the morgues in Melbourne were already full before the Black Saturday bushfires. And then, of course, we know that there are predictions about climate change in terms of fire risk, and we had that devastating event of the Black Saturday fires. So from a personal and professional level, it just seemed to me imperative that we needed to deal with this issue. As Ian said, it is concerning that a low proportion of people are thinking this is serious, so we do actually need to get the severity across. But I think we can take on board some of the other sciences, for instance, the psychology that tells us that not only do we have to tell people that this is a serious issue, but it has to be a serious issue for them. And also we have to somehow convey to people that, yes, something can be done about it. It's not too overwhelming. And they personally can be effective in doing something about it. And lots of the work that's done in health promotion in the health field teaches us these sorts of lessons. So we do have experience in this area to guide us. We can offer a choice. We can offer people a choice of a much more attractive future, a future where we can act for both health and the environment together, and there can be immediate benefits, so that rather than this problem being something amorphous and distant and not affecting them, it can become local and it can become relevant to them.
We're delighted to have Fiona Armstrong on the panel. Fiona is the convener and president of the Climate Change and Health Alliance, which is a coalition of more than 20 stakeholder organisations in the health sector. And their aim is to see the threat of climate change addressed through prompt policy action. Fiona works in policy research and advocacy, and she also has a background as a health professional, a journalist, a public policy analyst, and political commentator. So, Fiona, can you tell us a little bit more about your work and how the Climate and Health Alliance, how that operates, and just what your interests are and what your current activities are?
The Climate and Health Alliance, what do? We introduce into the public policy space the understanding that climate change does have health risks, and to bring the voice of health into the climate policy discussion, because it's currently missing. The debate seems to be around environment and economics. In fact, in Article 1 of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the central justification for acting to cut emissions is to protect health, and yet health doesn't appear in any of the mechanisms that have been developed to implement that convention, nor any of the programs that have been funded or developed to achieve those emissions reductions. We think that health is a very important voice in that space. The voice of health professionals is one that's respected in the community. So in trying to bring and build community support for action on this issue, when we know that public opinion can be very intransigent, then having the voice of people who do have status in the community as credible authorities is an important one, and we hope can help build support for action.
Late last year, the Climate Commission, which is the official government body, published its second report in its series of The Critical Decade. This report focused on the science and impacts of climate change and health. And so tonight we're pleased to have the Communications Director of the Climate Commission, who's Amanda McKenzie, on the panel. So Amanda, could you give us a bit of background to this, what I think is really seminal report and piece of science communication looking at health and climate change, and what the strategy of the Climate Commission is and why it's got this interest in health and climate change?
The Climate Commission, for those who don't know, was created around about this time last year, and the idea was to create a trusted, independent body on climate change that could cut through all of the opinion and present fact to the community. And the focus of the Commission through the last year has really been to go around, particularly to regional Australia, and present to a variety of different audiences, whether it's business, industry, community leaders, as well as public forums. And so there's been that regional focus, as well as doing some national reports. So the Critical Decade series started with a definitive report on the science. It continued with a range of regional reports around Australia about whether for Tamworth or South Australia or Tasmania, regional reports on what is the climate impacts for these communities. And then there was a health report at the end of the year. And the theme throughout all of these reports has been to try and make climate change a bit more real for people, a bit more tangible, putting it in plain language, the challenges to cut through to mediums that don't necessarily always write a supportive argument on climate change, but also audiences that aren't necessarily engaged with the issue. And I thought one of the things that we were thinking about last year as a Climate Commission was some of the characteristics of the current debate. And I think for those who are following the debate in sort of 2006, 2007, 2008, it was a very different scenario. It was almost like the perfect storm of a good scenario that we then had quite a positive debate in the media. And for any sort of issue of change, it's probably highly unusual that generally most people accepted the science and wanted action.
Fiona then went on to talk about the characteristics of the climate change debate. She mentioned how political leaders can really influence the perceptions of the public on whether or not they take action in climate change.
This goes to another characteristic, trust. When we saw the 2010 election, climate change became an issue of trust in government. The promise of we're not going to have a carbon tax, and then later a carbon pricing system coming in, whatever that debate is, it then started to become an issue of trust in the political debate, which I think then seeped gradually into the science as well, and an issue of can we trust the experts or can't we trust the experts? And when an issue is this complex and difficult and people do need to look to leaders, they need to look to experts, as soon as it becomes an issue of can we trust the experts, again, you start to lose ground. So I think that these are some of the characteristics that we're dealing with, as well as a powerful case for inaction that is advanced by a range of powerful advocates that have very loud megaphones. I think that the climate change and health aspects was, how do we change the conversation? How do we have a new conversation that's a bit away from all of this politics that people start to turn off from, and how do we remind people that this is real, this is tangible, this is local, and it's about humans? So refocusing it from the environmental issue to being about people and trying to develop that connection. I think the other fresh angle was to bring in as much as possible a new array of advocates, and although many people in the health professions have been doing a lot on climate change for many years, it still is relatively new to some parts of the media. If you look at research on climate change, some of the most trusted people are the local GP, because people trust who they know and they trust people who they trust on other things. So the idea was that if we could bring some health bodies in, bring GPs in to talk about it, you're bringing a range of unexpected trusted voices into talking about the debate. So I think it's stepping back into a new conversation about why does this really matter. It matters because climate change will affect humans, it'll affect us now, it'll affect us into the future, and that's the reason we need to do something about it. So really refocusing on the urgency of the issue.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
So there you have the speakers. Here are some of the edited highlights from the panel discussion. Marion outlines the awkward mismatch between public perceptions of biodiversity and the state's water supply.
You know, one example that comes to mind is I've been doing a bit of work in the area of biodiversity decline and how do we communicate the importance of biodiversity to people's health. And there have been some surveys that have done looking at what people want in terms of government action. And this survey showed that the majority of Victorians wanted the governments to act to secure their water supply. But then they also asked people what proportion of people wanted to have national parks and other forested areas protected, and it was only about 6%. And in fact, there's a very direct relationship between the quality of Melbourne's water supply and therefore the health of the population and those protected catchments that filter our water and provide all those ecosystem services, which otherwise we would have to have some sort of technology for. So there's this disconnect. We haven't been very good at telling those stories anyway, I think.
The panel then discussed the complicated issues concerning the communication of climate change and health for the general public. First Amanda, then Fiona.
I think there's a range of challenges in how to communicate this, and part of it is looking at the audience and what the audience is looking for. And the audience is looking for certainty and specificity, and that's exactly what we can't deliver. So they're looking for when is this going to happen, where is it going to happen, and how much it's going to cost. And particularly journalists, this is the consistent types of questions I get, and usually I can't really give them many of those answers. And the scientists just don't have the information to that level of detail. They can say broadly over decades when things will happen or over a broad region when things may happen. But there's always questions of may because it's obviously an uncertain area to predict into the future. So I think this is part of the problem is that journalists are used to expecting certainty on some things, and with anything that you're looking at the future, you can't expect certainty, and perhaps we haven't done enough to say, look, this isn't about certainty, this is about risk, and to frame it in terms of risk and to frame it with words like what's beyond reasonable doubt. You don't have to then say something certain or not certain, but it's beyond reasonable doubt, say, that humans are causing climate change. So I think that there's some ways to think about how we talk about certainty and how we talk about specificity, but I think we've got to be careful not to frame the issue how journalists or others who are asking questions come to us looking for certain certainties or specificity in other things, to frame the issue in our own terms.
I think in terms of how we communicate those risks, it's really important to always absolutely stick to the integrity of what we know and what we clearly understand, and not to exaggerate that, but not to retreat from it as well. And that is a continual challenge for advocates and communicators, to find that right balance between painting the picture that is a very accurate picture of future catastrophe, but also couple that with the opportunity for people to feel a sense of hope for the future, and that there are solutions that are out there that are within our reach, that are affordable and can bring about the change that's necessary.
There's some assumptions that we need to take a health approach because we've failed by taking a social responsibility or an environmental or an economic approach, and that this is all we've really got left if we want to create change. Is it that grim?
It is a really interesting notion that it's a strategy of last resort, that health is coming to the fore as the kind of frame in which to communicate and achieve action on climate change. But I think that there's a few reasons for that. I mean, one of them is that there's a very strongly prevailing economic meme, which is driven by our kind of obsession with economic growth, and that that must be maintained at all cost. And I think along the way, we've kind of lost our view of what a society is and that a society is constituted of humans and what the impacts are of those. So I think it is regrettable that we haven't had that emphasis on health in the past, but I think it's not that it's a strategy of last resort, it's just simply that it's been overlooked, that it's a very powerful one. We know when we poll the community prior to an election what the main issues are, and health is always in the top three. You know, economy is up there as well, but health and education are always high. So talking about health and linking health and climate change, because it wavers between sort of 8 and 16, depending on what's going on, is an opportunity to pull climate change up the list. But there is some really good evidence around using the health frame for climate change in the communications research as well, which indicates that when climate change is communicated as a public health issue, that people are more likely to perceive it as a personal threat and to see it in an individual context, and are therefore more likely to support action for mitigation. It makes climate change local and personal, whereas if it's described as a global environmental issue, it's distant in time and space. So, you know, that conjures up the images that have been used in advocacy in the past around polar bears and people in Bangladesh, and they've been threatened for a while, and we didn't sort of care too much about them. But if you make climate change about something that can affect you or your family or people that you know, and in a time frame that is meaningful, then people do perceive it quite differently and respond differently.
So if we personalise it, which audiences do you think that these messages are best suited for? And I guess what are those messages? You're doing work, Marion, with looking at, I believe, GPs and whether GPs should be interacting and talking about this sort of thing when someone comes into their clinic. Is that right?
Yes, I've just started on a new project with the University of Melbourne, and we're trying to look at, well, if we're encouraging GPs to talk about these health co-benefits, to incorporate sustainability into health, is that something that people will actually accept? Because obviously, you know, you come in with your sore toe or your cough and the doctor starts telling you about all the things you can do for sustainability in the planet, you may not necessarily agree with that. It may not go down very well. So we have to actually, this is all sort of new territory. We have to look at some of these things. A lot of these things are actually untested. But I think what we're really trying to do is we're really trying to tell people that we have to transform society. I mean, we're telling people that they have to move in different ways, use their car less, they have to have different sorts of houses, that we have to have energy from different sorts of sources other than we've had for maybe a century. And all these things together is actually quite a big thing to be asking people to do, but they may not consciously think of it that way. And so we do have to give them some good reasons for doing that, and we do have to make them personal.
So how do we get the message out?
I think one of the issues is that whether people have to act on an individual basis or whether they act on a collective basis. So I think it can be disempowering for people to learn about a massive global problem and then to think about, well, this is me at home, what sort of impact can I make? And even if I'm recycling, do I know if my neighbour's recycling and they're leaving the lights on, and really is my impact making any sort of difference? So I think it's important for there to be community leadership and opportunities in the community for people to come together to create change. And this could be quite simple, from, you know, the local school, how do we reduce the energy consumption at the local school? So rather than doing a project at home, bringing that into the community, involving many more people, so it's something that's making a broader difference in the community. I think we have a responsibility to communicate the reality of the situation, which is grim and potentially catastrophic, but I think we have to temper that with the opportunities and for people to be empowered and make a difference in their own life and in their community. I think can be very powerful.
Just a couple of examples, I guess, of how you might communicate those messages to different audiences, whether it's an individual or community or policymakers. I perhaps think about the groups that I might communicate to. And I think if you're communicating both the risks and benefits associated with health and climate change to an individual, it's possible, even in the context of people in Australia who, as you point out, are able to adapt. But there are many people who are vulnerable, infants and the elderly, and people don't necessarily anticipate well how heat waves, for example, can be debilitating, as evidenced by the fact that we had, you know, those several hundred people die and a spike in ambulances and myocardial infarcts and so on in the 2009 heat wave. So I think conveying to people that the health risks are real and that they will affect know, people right now, this is not something that's off in the future, themselves and their families, and they need to take steps to protect themselves. But there are also many personal benefits in terms of taking action on climate change by strategies to cut emissions that will deliver both individual and public health benefits. So moving to cleaner energy systems, for example, is an opportunity to clean up the air, reduce respiratory disease, provide us with energy security, and cut our emissions at the same time.
Fascinating discussion, and there's no doubt it's very hard to separate the economic, the political and social and health elements of climate change. Audience member Ian Barnes, retired academic, questioned the panel about the current model of capitalism as a hurdle to climate change. Here's what they said.
Now, who is it who said that the only person who thinks there's infinite growth on a finite planet is either a fool or an economist? I think we do need to challenge some of these paradigms. And I think, again, if you look at the issue of biodiversity, that gives us an example where we don't really have the value of clean air and clean water incorporated into our economic modelling. I think it's starting, you know, the ideas are getting through, but it hasn't been done very well. So maybe we could, rather than taking capitalism head on, we could be looking at some components of the way we think about that. You can act now to improve your health, and hey, guess what? It's good for the environment as well.
What we're staring down the barrel of is economic, environmental, and social collapse. And what is our research agenda doing to set us up to prepare us for that and to manage that? I don't think that it is in any way appropriate. Can I finish on a slightly more positive note as well? There is emerging evidence and good evidence about the economic benefits around the health co-benefits of action on climate change. A series of studies that were done, published in The Lancet in 2009, that looked at emissions reductions across a whole range of sectors and what the economic and health co-benefits would be of those. And they're really considerable. And there was also a very useful study done in Europe last year by Healthcare Without Harm and the Health and Environment Alliance that looked at the health co-benefits of stronger emissions reduction targets for Europe. And what that found was that moving to a 30% by 2020 emissions reduction target for the EU would save 80 billion euro a year by 2020 in avoided ill health and productivity gains. So the story about the opportunities for health is a very compelling one. And if we had some numbers to put to that, and if we had some numbers that we could point to in Australian jurisdictions and say, this is what climate action can deliver for us, that would make a very compelling story.
Wow, what an event. For more compelling stories about science in society, see the Australian Science Communicators website for your local events. See you there.